Welcome to the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Desa, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. My guest today is Dr. Alex Thomason, currently serving as the Department Head of Ag and Biological Engineering at Mississippi State. Dr. Thomason retired from the Navy in 2014 after 22 years of service. He began his career as an ag engineer and research scientist for the USDA Ag Research Service, specializing in electronics and machines for cotton ginning. Dr. Thomason then spent the next 15 years at Texas A&M University as a professor and ultimately the endowed chairholder in cotton engineering, ginning, and mechanization. It's here where I first met Dr. Thomason as one of my professors during my undergraduate studies in ag engineering. He's also an active member of the Federal Communications Commission Precision Ag Task Force Rural Broadband Development Working Group, helping bring connectivity to rural farmers. In this episode, Dr. Thomason delivers one of the most comprehensive and easy to understand overviews of what's happening within ag tech that I've ever heard. If you're even remotely interested in what ag tech is and what's happening right now, this episode is a must. His approach to servant leadership within his department is something he extracted directly from his time in Afghanistan as an engineer and should be an example for us all. I'm humbled to have had the opportunity to dig into Dr. Thomason's story. You'll be surprised by what I find. Enjoy. Dr. Thomason, I'm hoping we could start with what originally drew you to both the field of agriculture and the field of engineering, because I don't think that's something many of our listeners are aware regularly goes together.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I grew up in the city. I was not a farm kid. And we had relatives. I grew up in the Houston area. We had relatives in the country about an hour south of Houston who we went to visit pretty regularly. And they did some agricultural type things, and they were also into racing cars. And that was pretty exciting for me. My dad used to take me to the racetrack back in those days, and we could watch our cousins race in the races. And we went to visit them at their country home. We'd see them working on cars and, you know, hearing the loud engines with no mufflers and that kind of thing. And it was all very exciting for me. Then between my junior and senior years in high school, I was asked by a different cousin who happened to be farming soybeans out west of Houston, maybe an hour or so, to come and work for him on his farm during the summer. And I took him up on it. Day one, absolutely fell in love with everything that we were doing. I loved getting out there in the morning at 6 o'clock and crawling up under the tractor with a grease gun and greasing the tractor and being on the tractor and seeing what was going on and loading seed into the planter. Just loved every aspect of it. And I had never before that point known what I wanted to do in life, really. I mean, I had different thoughts about it, but I knew right then I wanted to be involved somehow in agriculture. So when I went to college, I saw this field of study called, at that time it was called mechanized agriculture. And there are different names for it now. Here at Mississippi State, we would call it AETB, Agricultural Engineering Technology and Business. It's sort of an engineering technology degree. At Texas A&M, it's called Agricultural Systems Management. So I went up there for my preliminary interview with the department head. This was at Texas Tech University where I did my undergraduate degree. And I talked to the department head and he said, hey, Alex, you know, let me recommend to you that you go the engineering route here. You've got good math scores. And I think that, you know, this would be a good opportunity for you. Not knowing any better, I just said, great, that sounds fine. That's the direction I went. I went into agricultural engineering, got my bachelor's degree, and ultimately started thinking about going into research and teaching, and went directly from my bachelor's degree at Texas Tech into a master's degree at LSU, Louisiana State University. Did remote sensing work there. This is back in the late 80s, and we were actually using remote-controlled aircraft as opposed to drones now, but we were putting cameras on RC aircraft and you know, back in those days, it was a lot more difficult because you didn't just have to tell the plane where to fly. You had to actually fly it, which if you weren't well schooled in that, meant you crashed fairly often and you brought the plane back into the lab and spent a lot of time repairing it, right? So I did that for a couple of years, got my master's degree, and then I went to work for USDA ARS, as you mentioned earlier. And during the 8 years that I was working there, I got on a what they called a long-term training program that allowed me to go to a university and get coursework towards a PhD. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the University of Kentucky for not a little less than 2 years, about a year and 9 months, got all the coursework that I needed towards my PhD. And then as I was back at my job with USDA ARS doing my research, I was using that research to develop a dissertation, which would ultimately allow me to graduate with my PhD from University of Kentucky. And that's what I did. Soon thereafter, I came here to Mississippi State back in 1997. So that's a bit about how I got into agriculture and the engineering track. I mean, you know, as I said, it wasn't something that I had a lot of purposeful thought about. It was just something that somebody presented me as an opportunity, and I trusted this person and went that direction, and it was just, it worked out beautifully.
I'm curious from your perspective, because you've been in this space, precision ag and remote sensing, for so long, that can you give the listener some sense of the kind of technology that's being employed today within agriculture?
So there are a number of technologies that are really expanding in agriculture. Sensing is one that is, I would say, prevalent and is growing fast. So sensing basically means that you've got usually some sort of electronic device that you're trying to make some measurement with. So an example of that would be you're on a harvester harvesting corn or cotton or soybeans, and you want to have some idea of how much of the crop is being harvested at any given location in the field. And so you've probably got a GPS unit on your harvester, and you've got some sort of computer system on your harvester that's recording data from the GPS unit. So let's say once per second, you're getting a latitude and longitude for your position in the field. And if you have a yield sensor or yield monitor on your harvester, you're also getting a data point that says how much crop you're harvesting at that particular moment. And so as those data are stored, and you get to the end of the field and you take the data back to your farm office, you can use software that will actually make a map of what the yield looked like in your field, which enables you to look at the map and say, this area yielded really well, that area did not yield very well. What's the cause of that? Are there things I need to do different in subsequent seasons to improve my yield in this area, or at least to improve my profitability in that area? You know, maybe this is an area of the field that for whatever reason, the soil quality is not very good. I'm never going to have very high yield there. And so maybe I'm going to reduce the inputs that I put out there. It could be fertilizer or herbicide or whatever it is that you're using, irrigation water, any kind of inputs. I may want to dial those back a little bit so my profitability is better. So those are, you know, that type of sensing technology is really expanding. We've gotten into the area now where we're trying to look at the health of the plants in the field by drones. So we might fly a camera, and it could be a relatively sophisticated camera, like a multispectral camera, which gives us wavelengths that we can't see with human eye. We may be looking at infrared reflectance from plants, and that'll tell us something about the health of the plant. And we could potentially make some changes in the way that we're dealing with those plants. Again, it could be irrigation. It could be something else that we want to do based on the map that we see after we've flown over the field with a drone and a camera. So sensor technologies like that are increasing. As we go from the type of sensors that measure one thing at a time, for example, the yield monitor that I was just talking about would give you one data point at a particular location. If you're using a camera, you get lots of data points at a particular location. So you take an image and, you know, if you look at the camera on your cell phone, it says it's a 1 megapixel camera or a 5 megapixel camera. That basically means you've got about 5 million data points for that image that you're taking. So as you go into image data, the amount of data that you've got really grows fast. And so that takes us into the space we call big data, you know, that if you Google big data, you get all kinds of discussion about research that's going on in big data. And big data is ripe for analysis by artificial intelligence algorithms. And so lots of software has been developed over the past few years, and the expansion in the field of artificial intelligence is pretty amazing. You're mining the data with artificial intelligence to find things in the data that are not obvious, right? Mm-hmm. So there are so many, usually when you get big data, there are so many data points, and there are so many variables that you're dealing with that historical, traditional statistical techniques of analyzing the data are very difficult to use, but artificial intelligence provides answers to questions that you really would have a hard time getting any other way. So we've got these new data available. We've got these new analysis algorithms that are available that enable us to have much better knowledge of what's going on with our crop and our farming system than we've ever had before. Other technologies that are really critical to this, when you have big data and you're in a remote farm field, you need to ideally move those data from point A to point B, right? So you may be working with, a John Deere system that is doing some cloud-based analysis. And what that means is you're automatically transmitting those data from the computer system on your tractor or harvester up into a cloud system that may be who knows where in the world. It's a computer system that can potentially perform artificial intelligence analysis on all the data you're collecting. But when you're in a remote farm field, what kind of transmission capability do you have? Maybe none. You may not have cell service there. If you do, it's probably low bandwidth. You may potentially have satellite service, but satellite service tends to be low bandwidth, and it also tends to be fairly expensive. So there's this new technology called edge computing, which means that you're doing a lot of computation actually on the device that's in the field. So, for example, the cell phone that you hold in your hand, if it's a smartphone like an iPhone or a high-end Samsung Droid phone, it's actually got a lot of computing capability on it that will allow you to do some artificial intelligence analysis on the device that's in the field. Really? So that's sort of an area of technology that's developing. So I'm trying to think where I've been. We've been the sensing, the big data, the artificial intelligence, the communications, and the edge computing. One other area that I think is really going to start growing rapidly is the area of robotics. If you followed the news, the technology news lately, you're probably aware that there are a lot of companies out there that are trying to automate cars and trucks on the highway. And there's an extent to which we already have that capability with new cars. I mean, you buy a new car and it will automatically slow you down if you're getting too close to the car in front of you when you're in cruise control. Or if you're veering into the next lane without turning your blinker on, it assumes that you don't know that you're veering into the next lane and it will warn you so you can get back into your lane. Those technologies have the capability to actually take over control of the vehicle. To be honest about it, for the last 15 plus years, probably, we've really had the technological capability to drive tractors and harvesters in the field with very high precision, with no input from the tractor driver at all. But we've not wanted to take the driver off for fear of what might happen if the driver's not there and something goes wrong. So does some implement that we're pulling with the tractor begin to malfunction? And what do we do about that? Does the tractor go haywire and get out onto the road and hit a bus full of kids going to school? That's, you know, a huge fear that we have about these kinds of things. But I think once we get to the point in the not too distant future where we have cars and trucks on the highway that are being driven autonomously, it becomes at that point a no-brainer that we can do it in agriculture where the risk to human life is much lower. So I think we're going to see robotics on farm developing over time. It may get to the point where we've got teams of small robots in the field as opposed to really large machines. The reason that we have really large machines in the field right now, both tractors and harvesters, is that we want to maximize the efficiency of the person who's driving that machine. We want that person to be able to influence as large an area of a field as fast as possible. If we don't need that person on the machine anymore, then we don't need that person to be maximized in the use of that machine. And we might take one harvesting machine and replace it with 10 small harvesting machines. And that would help us with soil compaction, for example, because the large machines that we have are very heavy and they tend to pack down the soil in the areas that they go through the field, which reduces yield. It may also help us to do some things that we can't do with large machines, like be more precise about where and when we harvest. We may want to harvest certain portions of the field at different times than other parts of the field. If we have one machine break down, we could still keep going with the other nine machines, for example. The whole operation doesn't shut down because one thing breaks. So there are lots of advantages to going from what I would call big iron to small iron in the space of agricultural machinery.
It's just so fascinating to me that we've come so far in such a short amount of time, and that to hear you describe the advantages of, for example, moving from big iron to small iron that can be attained by automation and autonomous capabilities is just, I haven't heard it put that way, right? So your one question I would have is that if the technology has been here for the last 10 or 15 years, and if there are so many primary, secondary, and tertiary benefits to broader adoption, why has it taken 15 years to get here, right? You mentioned fear, cost is probably an issue. Why else do you see technology being slow to adopt at the broader level here in agriculture?
Yeah, great question. I think that the capital available for development of this type of technology has only been available recently. I mean, you had until 5-10 years ago, you had traditional players in the market. You had John Deere, you had Case New Holland, you had AGCO, you had Kloss and Krona and some of the European companies and several others around the world. I mean, if you go to Japan, you've got Kubota and you've got Chinese manufacturers, but it was all traditional companies in the field up until a few years ago. And I think there were a few demographic trends that people started seeing, one of which is the rise in world population. You know, our population is expected to rise, say, 25% over the next 30 years. So that's an extra 2+ billion people that we have to add, which means that we have to add a lot more food production worldwide. We really don't have any more land to put into farming unless we destroy forests, which is a bad idea. Nobody wants that. Not to mention that as the standard of living around the world goes up, people's desire for animal protein goes up. And so as we have to produce more animal protein, we have to produce more plant protein to feed those animals. So the yield per acre or per hectare, if you will, of grain crops has to increase by a lot. There, you know, people have estimated from 25 to 75%. I'm sort of on the high end of that. I think we have to increase our per acre output on grain crops by at least 50%, probably to ultimately meet the demand that we're going to have 30, 40, 50 years from now. Yeah, lots of trends requiring that. And how do you do that? There are climate issues that we're dealing with. There are certain parts of the world that are probably going to be a little more droughty than they used to be. So how do we develop more drought-tolerant plants? How do we develop plants that are geared towards other parts of the world where maybe now they make sense and they didn't used to? So there's been a lot of interest in developing better crops, and that's from science and research standpoint. There's a lot of interest in optimizing the production of crops, and that's through some of the things we've been talking about, like precision ag and big data and robotics, to do the very best job on a plant-by-plant basis that we can possibly do.
If technology is getting smaller and, you know, presumably methods of power are also following suit, getting smaller, becoming more powerful, lasting longer, and edge computing is gaining traction where we have some ability to process larger amounts of data on device. Would we even need a bandwidth or a network infrastructure large enough to push large amounts of data over that network? Or could we do most of the processing on device and push only what we needed to over low bandwidth networks? I mean, in what instances would we really need to move large amounts of data to a cloud very quickly in order to achieve functionality?
Yeah, great question. I think there are some decisions that can be made very locally. Let's just imagine that you have one small robotic device that's in the field and it's sensing its surroundings, and maybe it's measuring plant health and soil characteristics and weed pressure and insect pressure and disease pressure and all these things. And it's trying to decide what it should do. If it has an algorithm built into it that accounts for sort of a historical understanding of what these things mean, then it could potentially make a decision and make an application at that location just strictly based on local data that it's seeing. I think the difficulty is that a lot of the decisions that need to be made on more of a comprehensive basis. So the decision that I make right here on this particular plant depends on what's going on in the entire field, or it depends on what's happened in this field or in this region for the last 50 years to really have an appropriate understanding. And at that point, it may be databases that exist up in the cloud that need to be analyzed to give you the right answer. And so there's a mix of both, I think, that's ultimately going to be required. In the shorter term, obviously, it's a lot easier to get to the localized answer, because if you can do everything here locally, you don't need that. And that's probably the earliest thing that we'll see. But in the long run, we may find great advantage if we ever solve the problem of being able to move lots of data back and forth to the cloud.
You and I were at a conference 2 years ago in Houston, one that you had put on around identifying obstacles to big data in agriculture. And one of the things that we talked about that really stuck with me was why GPS, for example, had so much adoption so quickly compared to something like variable rate technology, right? And how it was somewhere in the nature of 15 to 20% adoption and has somewhat plateaued. For those who weren't at that conference, can you explain why you think adoption for GPS was so much faster, so much quicker, and why something like VRT has been a little bit slower?
Yeah, I think so. So I would go a little bit beyond what you said. The adoption of GPS has certainly been there. The adoption of, for lack of a better term, automated steering has been pretty high. And that's typically a GPS-based system. So that's one of the reasons that GPS has been adopted so quickly, is because farmers, growers, have recognized the value inherent in having a machine drive itself, even though it's got a driver on board. And there are multiple reasons for that. One is that the driver is freed up from the responsibility of steering very carefully and can watch what's going on in the rest of the machine. If I'm planting, I can watch the planter and see what's going on with the planter. The driver also doesn't get fatigued as easily if for the most part, the machine is driving itself. Maybe they can drive longer hours. Maybe they can drive into the night where it would be difficult for the driver to see what's going on. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be out there in the dark. You'll have some lights on, but it's still more of a challenge to drive carefully at night, whereas the GPS will just continue to work and guide you no problem. The other issue is if you have RTK GPS, and RTK stands for real-time kinematic, which is basically means you're getting a correction signal from somewhere that's correcting your GPS signal so that it's very precise, and usually people say within 2 centimeters. So that's less than an inch. That means that you know that system knows where your tractor is in the field plus or minus an inch, and it can drive based on that level of precision. And a person cannot drive that precisely. The best tractor drivers are not that good. They might get close, but they're not that good. And so what that means is when you're planting in the field or you're plowing the field or whatever you're doing, you're minimizing overlaps, particularly if you're spraying, you know, and you don't want to put out more spray or fertilizer or whatever. You don't want overlaps in the field where you're doubling up material that you put out. And you also don't want to miss areas, which is pretty easy to do with a human driver, but with auto steer or some formulation of GPS-based guidance, you don't have those overlaps and misses in those areas. So the growers saw early on that that was kind of a no-brainer. It's worked great. Adoption's been very high. Variable rate technology has been more difficult to adopt because it's not obviously a moneymaker in a lot of circumstances. So the places that that started was in the Midwest. You have a lot of farmers who are growing corn and soybeans, and they have a lot of organic matter in their soil. They have really good soils, and they were going out and sampling their fields, and they might take a large field and sample it on a 2.5-acre grid. And they would collect these soil samples, and they would send them off to a laboratory. And the laboratory would analyze those samples, and they'd send a data sheet back to the farmer saying, you need to put out this much nitrogen, this much potassium, this much phosphorus, and they might tell you something about the soil texture if you paid them to analyze that. And on that basis, you might decide, hey, this part of the field needs this much nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and this part of the field needs this much. So we're going to arrange our system such that it applies roughly those amounts as it goes through the field. So what's the return on the cost of that technology? First, you have to do the soil sampling. There's a cost associated with that. There's the cost of paying the laboratory to analyze your data for you. Then there's the cost of actually having the equipment. I guess you have to make the map. There's some cost associated with that. And then there's costs associated with having the equipment to do that variable rate application. And it's not always obvious that the cost you're putting into that has a return on investment. In some cases, and I think that a lot of growers who have really taken the time and had the capability, sometimes with help from some consultants who are sort of technologically savvy, they've gone in and said, hey, this definitely pays, and this is roughly what it pays. Maybe it's $5 an acre or whatever it is. But if you don't have the ability to determine that and you're a money-making farm, it's easier just to do what you've been doing because I know I'm making money now and I'm not sure I want to spend that money on something that I'm not sure has a return. That's really the key. The more that we as researchers, in my humble opinion, the more that we can begin to show return on investment in some of the research that we do and some of these, what I would consider technologies that should be standard, the more that we're going to answer that question and make it more viable.
One thing I continue to hear you say is how not only varied but complex this entire system is from every aspect that you look at it, from the production side to the technology side to the incorporation side, from the economic sides. Did your time in the service and in the Navy help you, or has it helped you manage these complexities, manage these fluid, interconnected environments? We haven't really talked yet about your time in the service, but I know you'd mentioned it was in the Seabees, which is an engineering part of the Navy. How do these two industries connect for you? And do you draw from military service into the complexities that you face now here within agriculture?
Yeah, so brief background on my military career. I was actually working on my PhD coursework at University of Kentucky when I joined, and I did a direct commission straight into the Navy Reserve. So I had no, full-time active duty experience prior to that. Just direct commissioned as an ensign in the Navy, and went into a program called Engineering Duty Officer Program. And most engineering duty officers in the Navy are sort of shipyard construction engineering and that kind of thing. So most of my career, I guess the first 15, 16 years of the 22 that I did, was in that community, and I spent time in shipyards. I also spent because it sort of fit with my civilian career, I spent a lot of time in Navy research laboratory units where I was involved with what was going on at ONR and NRL type facilities. That was just helpful from the standpoint of learning technology and seeing what was going on in the Navy and in various research aspects of things that they were doing. The latter part of my career, the engineering duty officer community, particularly at the upper officer level, started drawing down a bit, and I was looking for an opportunity to stay engaged. And so I transferred over to the CEC, the Civil Engineer Corps. And a lot of Civil Engineer Corps officers spend their career sort of as base engineers, infrastructure, that kind of thing. But a segment of the CEC is focused on CVs. And so I got plugged into a, you know, I was asked when I was making the transition, I got a call from a detailer saying, sir, we want to approve your transition into the Civil Engineer Corps, but just want you to know that you're going to be assigned to a CV battalion. And it's very likely that your battalion is going to be mobilized to go to Afghanistan. And is that okay with you? Because we don't want you saying no if we approve your transition. And I said, well, you know, hey, I've been in for a long time and I haven't been deployed yet. It's about time for me to really, you know, serve my country in the way that I had intended. And so I said yes and got put into the CVs. And sure enough, within a year after that, we were deployed into Afghanistan. And to be perfectly honest with you, the things that I learned in my last few years in the CVs, part of this is because it's more recent in my memory, but also I think it was just because of the daily challenges. I learned so much during that time, that have been helpful to me in my career, both as an agriculturalist and probably even more than that as a leader. You know, you definitely learn a lot about leadership in the military. But when you get put into a situation like being in a CV battalion, and of course I was our admin officer, which isn't like tons of leadership, but you still have a lot of people under you, and you're trying to serve your battalion, and you're trying to make sure that they're taking care of all aspects. And as was also a company commander in our CV battalion, and just how do you deal with people, and how do you set an environment of the people that you're leading that encourages them, inspires them to serve one another, to serve the team, to serve the effort that you're all striving to accomplish? Those are probably some of the biggest lessons. The other thing I would say, just as somebody involved in agriculture and, you know, you sort of have this need to have a can-do attitude, get a lot done and be able to move from this evolution to that evolution really quickly because the weather changes or your machine broke down or, you know, you get a phone call and something's gone wrong. And your ability to pivot quickly, to be agile, to think quickly on your feet, all of those kinds of things are really prevalent in agriculture. They're also prevalent if you spent much time in the military, you've had to deal with them. And so those things, I think, transition really well between the two.
How was this sense of servant leadership and one of taking a position of inspiration as opposed to kind of direct leadership? Was that well received within the private sector for you as you either stepped into the endowed chair position at A&M or now the department head at Mississippi State? I mean, how has that approach to leadership been absorbed and perceived by your colleagues and your staff and your students?
Well, I'll just speak to the position that I'm in now, and I've been here almost 4 months now. And so it's a bit early maybe to have a complete gauge on that. And of course, I'm looking at it from my perspective and not that of others, but my sense is that it's been received really well. I have about 15 faculty members in my department, professors of various ranks, a handful of staff, a number of grad students, and of course we have 600 plus undergraduate students in our program. It's a large program. And my leadership has really been, I think, part of this is because we're in the pandemic days and we don't see much of each other face to face, right? A lot of our interactions are over meetings like this. And so the students up to this point haven't seen a lot of me, but the faculty members have and the staff has. I think they've been very receptive to it. I think it's critical for them. I mean, you know, when you think about what's the product that you're trying to produce at a university, you're trying to produce student learning and scholarship. Okay. Scholarship is basically research and artistic endeavors and things like that. In my case, it's really research. We're trying to move science and technology from point A to point B in a particular area. So that's one of the principal products. And the student learning, obviously, is the other product. We want to take students from a pretty rudimentary level of knowledge when they come here to a really high level of knowledge and experience so that when they go out into industry, they have a lot to offer there. Who does those things? The professors do, frankly. You know, they're where the rubber meets the road. They have the interaction with the students in terms of student learning. They have the interaction with the research endeavors in terms of advancing technology and science from point A to point B. And so we have to think about, as a department, what do those things look like as a group? And we're all working together, particularly from a student learning standpoint. And so working together as a team is essential for us to do our job well. You know, we can have 15 professors all who are great, but running in different directions. And we may have a few areas of research that are doing well, but there's nothing really cohesive. There's no cohesive product coming out of that. And our student learning could be the same thing, that we've got one group of students that's learning and another group of students that's not. And so it's really critical for us to work together as a team. And so that's sort of been my desire. Part of that's frankly through leading by example, right? I have not totally done away with my former life as a teacher and researcher. I'm not teaching undergraduate lectures anymore, but I still do have graduate students that I'm trying to teach on a different level, and I'm still doing research partly through them. And so being successful in that area to a small extent, because I want to be careful not to compete with my faculty members, but to the extent that I can be successful and they can see that, I think is an inspiration for them as well. But, you know, frankly, to me, it's all about getting everybody on the same page, seeing what the goal is, and having them desire to work together to meet that goal.
This has been an incredible discussion, Dr. Thomason, but as we wrap up, what is a piece of advice that you would give to a transitioning military service member, say myself, as I was leaving the Marines? What would you say to someone like me who wants to get back into agriculture, right? They may have an undergraduate degree in it. They may have some form of time that they spent on a farm growing up, but do you think that a master's degree is right? Do you think that, you know, getting back into the ag community as soon as you can and getting some OJT under your belt is the better way to go? What would you say to that veteran that wants to get back into agriculture or get into agriculture?
Well, I wish I had one single answer, but I have two or three. One of those is, you know, is develop a network. And probably that's a bit related to OJT. If you could work for somebody for a while, you know, even so, I went to Australia a number of years ago and I learned something there that was quite interesting. There were people who were going on holiday from Scotland, for example. I met a Scottish guy who had taken a vacation and gone to Australia for most of a year, spent some of the time vacationing there, but basically paid for his trip by driving a combine on a farm in Western Australia. Hmm. And there was sort of a network that some of the farmers over there had with some people in the UK. And every year they had a certain number of people come over and work for them. If you had an opportunity to spend some time on a farm working like that, that experience and the knowledge that you gain there would be invaluable. Also, the network that you would develop there would be invaluable. I would encourage also taking some college coursework just in fundamental agronomy. That could be done at the undergraduate level or the graduate level, but knowing what the makeup of soils is and soil fertility and plant science, how plants grow and the physiology of plants. And some of those fundamental courses that you would take in agronomy are really critical. The other thing I would say is if you haven't taken some basic business courses, that would be the next thing that would be really important, because you can be a great farmer and grow great plants, but if you're not taking care of the business side of it, you're not going to make money and you'll have to quit, right? Those would be my three bits of advice, I think.
Well said. A very fitting end to what in my mind has been a fantastic discussion. So thank you very much, Dr. Thomason, for agreeing to be a part of this and for your insights, the direction that you're taking the university now, for your willingness to stay involved in points where the rubber meets the road. And I certainly couldn't be more excited about what the next 20 years look like in agriculture.
Great. Thanks, Mike. It's been really fun. Nice to be able to chat with a former student in a context like this, and, you know, keep doing what you're doing. I think this is pretty exciting to see these podcasts coming out. Glad I can be a part of it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Thomason. Thanks, everyone, for listening to our first episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. It's not often you get the opportunity to interview one of your former professors about their life and work. For that and many other reasons, I really enjoyed this interview. The way Dr. Thomason was introduced to engineering and agriculture is incredibly grassroots, and I hope will resonate with the listeners. His overview of what's happening within ag tech today, from sensing, big data, and artificial intelligence to communications, edge computing, and robotics, is about as comprehensive as I've ever heard. Dr. Thomason also talks about certain adoption curves with GPS-enabled auto steer and variable rate technology, for example, in a logical way that I think should speak to ag tech startups as they look at how best to increase adoption at the farmer level. As a professor and university department head, Dr. Thomason has a keen sense of how to explain complicated topics in a way that's easy to understand. If you're a veteran new to ag tech and want to learn more, this episode is really a must. If you enjoyed it and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from the insight shared by Dr. Thomason, please leave us a review on Apple iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts and share on social media. You can also find this episode and future episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at www.desaconsultingllc.com, DESA Consulting LLC.com, and by clicking our news feed. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters who are leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Desa, and until next time, stay frosty.